Life.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
Protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Privacy.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Movement.
Movement.
It's my mistake, and let me make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression,
expression.
Expression, expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
work,
leisure,
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 health,
education,
focus,
culture,
human rights,
Charter Dana,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sastel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings. With me today is my co-host Gord Barnes and our special guest, Amnesty International Aboriginal Rights Campaigner Craig Benjamin, here in Saskatchewan for a special tour. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you here.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. And Craig, do want to as well extend a welcome to Saskatchewan. It's by no means the first time you've been in Saskatchewan, and we've certainly appreciated your support every time you've been here to speak to groups, to community groups, to schools, and talk about the work that Amnesty International undertakes to support the human rights of Indigenous peoples in Canada. And so special welcome to this trip. And
Thank you.
It's really going to be an interesting discussion through this program.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always appreciated every opportunity I've had to come here, both because of the vibrancy of our own member activism, but because of the great connections that have been built over the years with so many human rights activists, especially those in the Aboriginal community, the grassroots activists, the leaders, the experts, and others. And I always come away having learned a lot and being very inspired as well.
Great. So the key theme of your trip this time is around Amnesty's work to support the First Nations Child and Caring Society of Canada and their Dreams Matter campaign. And maybe for our listeners, you'd like to give a little bit of background about what that campaign's all about and who the First Nations Child and Caring Societies is and what their work is all about.
Sure. The First Nations Child and Family Caring Society is one of those really inspirational organizations. They work across Canada to advocate for the rights and the well-being of First Nations children. First of all, children who were in the family care system. But beyond that, they have worked on a wide range of issues where there is a gap in the quality and the accessibility of basic services for First Nations children living on reserve. So this is the organization that has promoted Jordan's Principle, which is the principle about equal access to health care for First Nations children. This is the organization that is before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal with a discrimination case around the underfunding of First Nations Child and Family Services. And they're the organization that has launched a campaign called Shannon's Dream, which is about closing the gap in access to good quality education on reserve. The organization is led by a dynamic and inspiring activist, educator, and researcher by the name of Dr. Cindy Blackstock. And she is somebody whose work, the research is so good and so fantastic that I think it's something that deserves the attention of all Canadians and deserves the support of all Canadians because of the really fundamental issues of discrimination, which she has helped to expose and to bring to life.
So Amnesty members across Canada will probably be well aware of the support we've tried to provide through the Have a Heart campaign each year that takes place in February. And that's maybe just give a little bit of background about that particular campaign that takes place every year. And
yeah, in fact, there are two times each year in which the various themes that the Child and Family Caring Society are working on, the issues of children's health, child and family services, education for First Nations children, they're all brought together into days of education and action. And the first, as you mentioned, is Have a Heart Day, which is on and around February 14th each year. And the basic action there is sending Valentines to the Prime Minister, asking the Prime Minister to have a heart for First Nations children. And as you said, our members across the country have been very active in support of this campaign. It's been about 3 years running now that we've been really involved with this. And the other major date is June 11th, which is the anniversary of Canada's apology to the residential school survivors. And the focus of that date is, again, letter writing, calling for basic fairness, basic respect for the human rights of First Nations children, access to those same services that other kids get to take for granted. And one of the focuses of the day is that walks are organized in communities across the country. So, for example, in Ottawa, I've had the chance to participate the last couple of years in the walks. And one of the really great things about both dates is that these are not only days of action about the rights of children and young people, they're actually days of action that in many ways are led by children and young people. And when you take part in these events, you see an extraordinary level of participation from children and young people of this really amazing age range, who you see what Dr. Blackstock, what Cindy Blackstock always says about this is that when you hear the voices of young people talking about this issue, they cut right to the chase. They go right to the heart of the matter, which is that the current treatment of First Nations children is unfair. And 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, they can see this immediately when they're presented with the facts. And unfortunately, it's only when you've built up years of exposure to the racism in Canada, to the discrimination toward Indigenous peoples, that you can sort of start taking it for granted that there is such inequality. And children come to these issues with a fresh eye and don't hesitate to call it like it is and say, this is just not fair. Mm-hmm.
You know, Jim and I both were very fortunate a few years ago to hear Cindy Blackstock speak at the Amnesty International annual meeting in Vancouver. And I was so impressed, and I know everybody else who was there. It was a memorable annual meeting to be able to have her as a guest speaker. But one of the things, Craig, that I recall very well from somebody who's in our own community who works at the University of Regina is that when they're trying to recruit First Nations students into the nursing program, he indicates that it's difficult to do that because students who have gone to school, First Nations students who have gone to school on reserve, are missing one of the basic credits to get in because it's offered in off-reserve schools but not on First Nations schools, and it's an issue of money. It's simply an issue of money. And that, to me, is just such a telling inequity. And when everybody wants to see young people get into nursing as an option, it's just really unfortunate that that's going on still.
Yeah, that's just one example of a larger pattern. I've worked with First Nations communities who are in the heart of some of these major resource development projects that are going on across Canada. And these are always being promoted as a great opportunity for jobs, especially for young people. And many of these First Nations very much want the jobs, but the fact is that their own education system, which may only offer the most general credits quite often, doesn't actually prepare the students to qualify for the jobs even where they are available. And as you say, it does come down to an issue of funding. And this really shouldn't be a matter of controversy. It's so well established now. The Parliamentary Budget Office, this is the body set up to provide independent expert analysis of the federal government budgets. The Parliamentary Budget Office concluded in 2009 that funding for First Nations schools on reserve was less than half of what would be required to ensure access to a decent education in safe, comfortable classrooms and on a par with the education generally available to non-Aboriginal students and to students going to school, in cities like Regina. And it's a matter partly of an actual underfunding in comparison to the funds allocated for schools in non-Aboriginal communities, but it's also a matter of the funding formula has not taken account of the high costs of providing services in small and remote communities, and the funds that have been allocated have not kept pace with the times. So that there's been a steady, year after year of insufficient funding has created in many communities a crisis situation, where schools have been underfunded so long that they're in really sorry state of repair, such that it may actually be unhealthy for kids to go there.
So maybe, Craig, if you could just spend a little bit of time talking about, because you referenced the complaint that is before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, and maybe give our listeners a little bit of background and context for that.
Sure. This is actually one of the really most significant human rights campaigns happening in this country right now, and in my opinion, both because what's at stake, which very much goes to the future for First Nations kids, like you said right off the start, but it also goes to the basic quality of Canadian society and Canada's commitment to fairness and to human rights. The case concerns another aspect of this problem of underfunding of services for kids on First Nations reserves. And this is funding for child and family services. Now, just to take a step back, people may not be aware that uniquely services such as child and family services or education or health care on reserve falls under federal jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So here in Regina, it falls under the jurisdiction of the provincial government as it does elsewhere in Canada. Uniquely in First Nations reserves, the jurisdiction is federal. The standards which may apply may still actually be provincial standards. And this is the case for child and family services. Provincial standards are the standards that are used, but the funding is set by the federal government. And for child and family services on reserve, per child, the money allocated by the federal government is more than 20% less per child than the money provided in non-Aboriginal communities.
That's very significant.
So yeah. that's the starting point is the per child funding, but then just as in the case for all the other services, you also come up against the fact that it's more costly to deliver the services, and particularly importantly for child and family services, often the need is greater. Canada has officially and formally apologized for the residential school era. June 11th is the anniversary of that apology. That apology acknowledged that there was, for generation after generation, a systematic effort to break down Aboriginal families, break down Aboriginal culture, tear apart children from their parents, children from their communities, children from their culture, and that we are still today living with the legacy of harm that caused. Well, part of that legacy is to create a much greater need for proper services for child and family support. The failure to even meet the levels of funding available for non-Aboriginal children has in many First Nations communities created a crisis of childcare, where families are simply not getting the supports that they need to make sure that the children could grow up safely and properly provided for at home. What's happening today is that a larger number of First Nations children are being taken away from their families and communities than at the height of the residential school era.
Isn't that an incredible statistic? You know, that is amazing.
Yeah, and they're being taken away, not primarily, as some people might assume, because of abuse, because of threats to their lives and safety, but because of what's called neglect. Mm. The families are simply not able to adequately provide for these children without assistance. But underfunded child and family services can't provide that assistance. All they can do is move to that last resort of taking the children away. Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, some of the fundamental harms inflicted by the residential school program are being repeated for this current generation. And part of the solution, the fundamental part of the solution, is to deal with the funding. Cindy Blackstock's organization tried for years to address this for other means. Our first work with Cindy dates back now almost a decade, where we got involved in a letter writing action as part of our annual December letter writing marathon.
Right.
We asked our members across Canada to write to the government and provide adequate, equitable funding for family services for First Nations children. Our efforts, the much more extensive work that was done by Cindy Blackstock, by the Assembly of First Nations, all seemed to fall on deaf ears. And eventually, in desperation, Cindy Blackstock's organization, the Child and Family Caring Society, and the Assembly of First Nations launched a human rights complaint that went to the Human Rights Tribunal. This is the body. It's a quasi-judicial body. It has enforcement powers, and its job is to enforce the Canadian Human Rights Act. And the allegation which these organizations brought forward was that the treatment of First Nations children, this underfunding of child and family services, was an act of discrimination and therefore violates the Canadian Human Rights Act. And we've actually joined in that case. We have Amnesty sought status to present to that tribunal as well, because we feel not only is the treatment of First Nations children a violation of the Canadian Human Rights Act, but also it's a violation of international human rights standards, which that Canadian Human Rights Act is supposed to help us live up to.
So the federal government is actually, if there's been a need to proceed with a complaint, the federal government has been unwilling, therefore, to respond to the concerns that are raised by the First Nations communities across Canada, by the First Nations Child and Caring Society. Do you get any sense that there is some movement at all through the last few years, or is it still a question of resisting the concerns that are being expressed by so many people across Canada?
You know, in some ways, the answer is that both things are true.
Okay.
We do see some movement in all of the issues which are being raised by First Nations communities. We do see some movement. We do see here and there some additional funds being allocated. Mm-hmm. Here and there, we see a particular community getting what they've struggled for. But the response is always so piecemeal.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a comprehensive response to what are comprehensive problems.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a national response to what are national problems. And the responses always fall so far short of the need that in many cases either you see a failure to see the gap close significantly, or in fact you see the gap continue to widen as the deficits of the past aren't addressed. Earlier I referred to the Parliamentary Budget Office. Well, I mean, here's another source of information on this. This is the Auditor General of Canada, whose work has been very well respected. In 2011, the Auditor General of Canada, looking back over a history of that office's reports on the funding and delivery of services on reserve, concluded that the education gap has actually widened, that the shortage of adequate housing has increased, and that the comparability of child and family services has never been ensured. So again, you know, looking to these independent expert voices whose job it is to monitor government performance, they are saying that what has happened has fallen so far short of what's needed that, in fact, the gap has widened.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that the government's resistance comes in another form, too, and that has been the deeply adversarial response to the efforts of organizations like the Child and Family Caring Society to bring these issues to light. Many people may have already know the fact that the federal government cut the funding to Cindy Blackstock's organization. Canada's Privacy Commissioner ruled in her favor to say that they had violated her privacy rights by the degree of surveillance that she had been subjected to because of her work. And the case before the Human Rights Tribunal, the Canadian government has fought that case tooth and nail, resulting in it being dragged out year after year. And they fought this case using legal arguments that would have the effect that if they were successful, not only of denying this case, but in our view, actually drive a hole in the Human Rights Act in a way that would seriously undermine the rights protection available to a great many people in this country.
So the resistance is pretty significant then on the part of the federal government. And despite the appeals that thousands and thousands of Canadians will have written their members of parliament about, they're just not willing to address this issue.
You know, this is I think a very challenging thing for all of us to think about as activists, is that, you know, sometimes we work on cases or we work on issues where there is both an obvious solution and a short path to achieving that solution. It's a matter of just the right person at the right place making the right decision, and we can set things right. But so often when we're dealing with the discriminatory policies toward First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people, we are facing a real uphill battle because the discrimination is so deeply ingrained. And the fact is that when we raise these issues, the government always has a single pat response, which unfortunately still seems to resonate and be accepted among a large part of the Canadian public. Whenever we raise any of these issues, the immediate response of government is to start rolling out figures of money that is being spent on this program, that program. And the figures always sound like a lot of money being spent on services to Indigenous people in Canada. But because no comparison is provided to the services provided to non-Aboriginal people, you miss the true story. You miss the true point of the fact that the funding is actually grossly inadequate. But still, this is the response we hear every time. And it seems to help play into and reinforce a certain apathy among part of the public. And I think this is why it's so crucial that organizations like ours, in fact, really anyone concerned with human rights, with fairness, with justice, learn more about these issues, get more involved. To quote Cindy Blackstock on this issue, she said that these inequalities are not just a First Nations issue. They're fundamental to the well-being and the morals of this entire country and its human rights obligations domestically and internationally. I think it's so important to keep in mind that while this has been a campaign that has been led, that has been, you know, the work of exposing it has come from First Nations organizations and activists like the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, ultimately, you know, the responsibility for bringing about this change is all of ours. And in fact, if we don't see, you know, that kind of mass movement of to expose and to press for change, the change isn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the things we might talk a little bit about in the second half of the program even is that it seems to me the federal government response often as well says to people, well, you know, if they'll move forward with resource development and agree to do that in their communities, then there can be appropriate levels of funding. That's the solution that's being proposed. And to me, that is such a disrespectful way of moving forward on that question as well, because those discussions need to take place, from my perspective at least, in a way that respects First Nations rights to consultation about resource development and whether they want to see it happen in their traditional territory.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think this is why it's so important to say over and over again that education, culture, health, the safety of children, these are all human rights. And as human rights, nobody should be forced to bargain for them. And nobody should be forced to engage in trade-offs where you say, well, in order for my child to have access to a proper education, they have to leave their land and their culture behind. Or in order to bring the money into our community to provide for a standard of health or education that other people in this country enjoy, we have to accept forms of development that we don't want, that according to our own values, our own decisions, are not appropriate. Those kinds of trade-offs and the pressure upon First Nations, upon Métis communities, on Inuit people to make those kinds of trade-offs is really, really ultimately unacceptable.
So are we kind of close to the break there, Jim? How are we doing for time?
Oh, we're doing pretty good here now. And, of course, we're looking forward to some music. We've got some great music coming up here an artist that you and I have both heard before. And his name is George Leach.
Okay.
And what was the occasion? It was an Aboriginal showcase of talent, I think, over at the Artful Dodger.
That's right. It was very good. It was just excellent. And yeah. I think it was an evening that was put together by our friend from Achapois. Right.
Errol?
Errol Kinistinel. Yeah, you got right. it. So it was a really good night.
Right, and, it certainly was.
Yeah.
And then we subsequently discovered that when the Junos were happening here not too long ago, George got a Juno for his work with blues music, Aboriginal blues, and very well deserved. So right after the break, we will hear some George Leach, and then we'll continue this discussion.
Love.
And I would say that you can kind of tell why George got that Juno.
Yeah, good choice.
Very, very impressive. Very impressive musician, for sure.
That's right. So for our friends who are just perhaps tuning in to the second half of the program on Human Rights Radio, our special guest is Craig Benjamin. And Craig is the Amnesty International campaigner on the human rights of Indigenous peoples. And Craig, we indicated earlier we wanted to welcome you to Saskatchewan. You've been here before, but you know it's also appropriate to say welcome to Treaty 4. And we perhaps neglected to do that at the beginning of the program. We've often talked about on this program how we are all treaty people. We need to respect and learn as we go through the process of respecting treaties about that process. So welcome again to the program. And it's been a great discussion so far. We were talking just before the break a little bit about the response of the federal government often when people have said, you know, there needs to be equity in funding for children who are going to school on reserve or for their other services. It seems often that the response of the federal government is, well, if you move forward with that resource development, you can have the equity in funding. And it doesn't seem appropriate in terms of a way of responding to a demand that is quite reasonable. And maybe you'd like to comment a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, quite simply, I mean, nobody else is asked, you know, to make these kinds of trade-offs. You know, the fact is, when we talk about education for First Nations kids, when we talk about healthcare for First Nations kids, we're talking about access to services that the vast majority of Canadians can take for granted. Mm-hmm. The campaigns like Our Dreams Matter Too are not campaigns for more for First Nations kids. They're for First Nations kids to have access on a level playing field, to have access to these services in their own communities, to have access to services that are geared to their needs and which are properly funded and properly supported. The other thing about tying access to these services to First Nations agreeing to particular programs or projects. And exactly as you said, we are certainly hearing this as a growing refrain from politicians in Canada that I've seen this in many parts of the country where I visited, where First Nations are in fact being told, you know, that if they have concerns about quality of education, they should be agreeing to accelerated resource development. That is something that is definitely happening. But it's so incredibly short-sighted. I mean, the pattern of resource development that we have seen typically is not bringing long-term wealth to any communities. When we look at the jobs that are created, they are typically the greatest spike in jobs is very early on in the process. To tie something like access to education, which is long-term, multi-generational, to something that may be very, very short-lived is also, I think, a very questionable approach. But again, the heart of it is still that this is simply choices that other people are not being asked to make.
Mm. So, Craig, you know, I think people who are listening to this program, for the most part, are going to agree this is fundamentally unjust, that young people who are going to school on reserve are going to schools that are significantly underfunded compared to schools off reserve. This is just a fundamental question of human rights. And I guess what people probably are wondering about is, you know, what are the different ways or options of how they can get involved in supporting the work of the First Nations Child and Caring Society and also Amnesty International to right this very fundamental injustice?
Well, the great thing is that there are so many ways to get involved. And one, the simplest, most basic things people can do is to show their support for the incredible work being done by the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. On their website, you can directly join any of their campaigns. It is simply an expression of your support as a member of society for what they're doing. You can join campaigns like Shannon's Dream for, as the campaign says, safe and comfy schools for First Nations kids. You can join the Jordan's Dream campaign, which is a campaign for equity and access to health care. You can join I Am a Witness, which is about this case before the Human Rights Tribunal. Their website as well has an incredible range of resources to promote greater understanding of the issues for a wide range of audiences. They have fantastic resources for bringing these issues into the schools to make them part of the curriculum. Great tools for engaging young people in social activism, in really in citizenship. And they have great resources for other kinds of or groups and organizations from community clubs right on up. Ultimately, you know, there is still a tremendous value in writing letters to government. I know it may seem quaint or old-fashioned, mm-hmm. but the fact is that when you think about the money which politicians spend on polls, is one measure of the fact that they are concerned about public opinion. And they are concerned, and when you look at how polling operates, polling is meant to determine not just what people feel about an issue, but their depth of a feeling, how committed they are, how likely they are to act on this belief. So when you have a chance to be in contact with your member of parliament, to be in contact with a cabinet minister, it's an opportunity to show them that the public does care about an issue, but most importantly, you want to show them the depth of commitment. That act of actually taking the time to write a letter is one way of showing that depth of commitment. And we do know that you know, a significant number of people writing and raising an issue can make a difference. Even better, and I think this is so important, if you do write a letter to a member of parliament, if that member is a member of the government, you're pretty much guaranteed to get back a very pat form letter that, like I said earlier in the program, will reassure you about all kinds of money being spent on this program or that program, but won't address that fundamental question of the sweeping, systemic, pervasive inequality in access to services that occurs coast to coast to coast. If you receive a letter like that, it's an opportunity for you to write again. And that act of writing a second time shows both even greater depth of commitment and shows that you're not easily fooled. Mm-hmm. And I really strongly encourage people to be persistent. So, again, I really want to come back to that act of letter writing. I know that the Amnesty members here in Regina have a weekly letter writing session. I think that that's a fantastic tool. And it's a great thing to encourage. And it's a great opportunity to get together with like-minded people as well. We have letter writing actions on our own website. If that's not your thing, but you still like the idea of getting together with other people and discussing the issues and trying to make a difference, another thing I'll recommend is that we had a tremendous opportunity this year with the launch of the Amnesty International Book Club. We got to work with Joseph Boyden. Joseph Boyden is a Canadian author who has tackled in a really moving way in both fiction and nonfiction, the state of the relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people in Canada. Our first book club book was his Joseph Boyden's 3-Day Road, and part of the focus of that discussion guide that goes for the book club was the issue of residential schools, their legacy, and how many of the same patterns of discrimination and racism are playing out today, and what our responsibilities are as people living today in this society to finally right this wrong. So a book club may be another way to engage people on the issue, another way to get people together and to start having that conversation and begin that process of affecting the kind of deeper sea change in public opinion that we're going to really need to accomplish.
Mm. You know, I think that's a great suggestion. He has also more recently been very well recognized for another book, and that's Arenda.
Yes.
And probably people are very well aware of that one because it's got national recognition quite recently. You know, Craig, when I think about this particular issue, it seems to me that in many, many communities across Canada, and this spills over to so many of the other issues related to the human rights of Indigenous peoples, we are still such a divided people. So many people in our communities, you know, live in neighborhoods where there are significant divisions, and we need to have ways of having conversations that will bring people together. And surely this is a particular conversation that people right across Canada can have without really getting into significant disagreement with each other. I personally hope that that's something that people will, you know, in their own neighborhoods, try to undertake.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I do think that if we come down to what are we talking about? We're talking about the future of the next generation of young people in this country. Mm-hmm. And I think particularly here in Saskatchewan, where you know we recognize that those young Aboriginal kids are really in so many ways the future of this province. To be shortchanging those kids today, mm-hmm. By denying them access to a proper education, by denying them access to health care on the same basis as other kids, that's shortchanging the entire province.
Mm. And that goes wrong right across Canada, right? It's an issue that people, I'm sure, will, as they hear more about this, it's been in the news a lot because of some of the work that Cindy Blackstock and others have undertaken, but I think as people begin to get their heads around this issue, they'll really get involved and say to their members of Parliament, this is something we need to come together around and address.
Yeah, and I really encourage people, if nothing else, bring a critical eye to these issues. When you hear politicians spouting numbers about money spent on this program or that, stop for a moment and question how that might compare to the money spent on the services that you enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hear politicians trying to pass the blame by pointing the finger at First Nations leadership, pointing the finger at Chief and Council, stop and question, what is the role of the federal government? What is the power exercised by that federal government over First Nations today? And ask whether they're really fulfilling their responsibilities.
Mm.
Because that's where we have influence. That's the government we can hold to account. And that's the government we have a responsibility to hold to account.
Mm. So you'll be having this conversation with a lot of people in Saskatchewan over the time you're here, traveling throughout Treaty 4 and other parts of the province. We really, really do appreciate you taking the time to be on Human Rights Radio today. It's just been a fabulous discussion. Jim, how are we doing for time today? Are we got a few minutes yet? Or
We have a couple of minutes. I was just going to ask Craig a question that occurred to me earlier. You were talking about an event in Ottawa with Cindy Blackstock and getting the children out for a demonstration. And I was just wondering if these were all Aboriginal children or were they local school children from the Ottawa area? Or
It's been both, and it's been really fantastic to see. On February 14th for Have a Heart Day, on June 11th for Our Dreams Matter Too, we've seen incredible participation of schools that are primarily non-Aboriginal students,
mm-hmm.
and we've seen participation from some of the nearby First Nations have tremendous education systems which they have been able to control and build.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is the other side of the story, it's important to keep in mind that although there's severe federal underfunding, that there's also a lot of innovation mm-hmm. out there among First Nations around education. And so many First Nations also have their own education systems that they're very, very proud of. And so we've seen a coming together in Ottawa of kids from one of the First Nations schools, from a nearby Algonquin First Nation of Kitigan-Zibi, and kids from predominantly non-Aboriginal schools. It's been really fantastic to see them coming together in mm-hmm. this way. And, and I think that when we talk about education, part of the education responsibility is that responsibility for non-Aboriginal people to educate themselves,
exactly.
ensure that their own children
yep.
grow up with a proper education about the treaty relationship, about the history of Aboriginal people in this country,
mm-hmm.
about Aboriginal society, about the aspirations of Aboriginal peoples, and about the ways in which Canadian society has set up barriers to those aspirations or has failed Aboriginal people through things like the residential schools. I know that when I grew up,
mm-hmm.
As a non-Aboriginal person, I grew up in Nova Scotia, and my education did not include any meaningful consideration
yep.
of really one of the most fundamental parts of our history as a people in this country. And I'm the poorer for it today.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. I feel the same way when I look back on the things that I... actually, we learned very little about First Nations people. They're just kind of there, and we took over. Only it wasn't put that way, but that's basically what happened. And I think it's so valuable to get our young people educated so that they know exactly what has happened. And I think our government is taking advantage of the lack of information that's out there with people my age, and if we can educate our young people, it won't be as easy for them to do the stonewalling they've been doing.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think that's why it's just so fantastic too that the organizations like the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society have done such a great job in enabling young people to get involved, to act as citizens, to engage in that learning, and to work hand in hand with other young people, kids their own age, who are First Nations on a common cause that really is about improving society for all of us.
Well, thanks very much, Craig. It's been great having you here, and I know that the people in Saskatchewan are going to really learn a lot and get excited about the things that are happening in terms of improving First Nations access to education and health care. So thanks very much. As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."